Welcome to Radio Free Albion with Tony Trigilio. My guest today is C.M. Burroughs. I'll be talking with CM about her poetry collection, The Vital System, which was published in 2012 by Tupelo Press. Welcome to Radio Free Albion. This is Tony Trigilio, and I'm talking today via Skype with CM Burroughs. CM Burroughs is the author of the poetry collection, The Vital System, which was published in 2012 by Tupelo Press. She has been awarded fellowships from Yaddo, the McDowell Colony, Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, Idlewild Arts, and Cave Canem Foundation. And both the Studio Museum of Harlem and the Warhol Museum have commissioned her to create poetry in response to art installations. She lives in Chicago, where she is the Elma Stuckey Emerging Poet in Residence at Columbia College Chicago, and where, I should add, she will officially be joining the core poetry faculty in fall 2013. Hi, CM, how are you doing?
Hi, Tony, I'm great. You can't see me, but I'm sitting up a little straighter in my chair for this interview.
Well, you know, you can't see me. I put on my sneakers for this interview so I can feel like I'm out in the world professionally, you know, and people don't know that I do these interviews only with audio, so like all I can see are people's icons, but I'm wearing shoes, definitely. So, you know, I should let everybody know that CM was one of the first people I talked to about doing an interview on this show way back when I hardly had any audio equipment and the podcast was just some impossible idea that I had in my head. So I'm glad we're finally doing this.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I've always thought about the radio as a great space. I love listening to it. So why not, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's just I think the podcast idea comes from being a kid and how I used to, you know, really late at night, used to listen to talk radio, not like the crazy, you know, talk radio we have today, but just like late night people in far-flung cities talking about books and music. And I thought, wow, there are people out there. I'd like to do this.
Yeah. I wish we could get back to that. People could get back to that.
Yeah. I think so. And podcasts are, you know, in their best incarnations can do that, I think. And I hope this one does that. Well, let's talk about the vital system. You know, when you think of your ideal reader for this book, what would you want the reader to know about you as a person or as a writer or both, you know, before they jump into the book?
Well, I like to think about a reader as being very open. And so I'd like a reader to know that what is in the book for me is very true. And so that if they can walk into the book feeling, okay, I'm entering something that's completely honest right now and how I experience it, should just be with some kind of openness. And that's what I really appreciate from a reader.
And it's like we want a reader to come in. I love that idea to just, you know, that I'm coming as a reader into a space of openness and truth. And at the same time, like, we know that we might be lying all the time in our poems.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of like emotional honesty, maybe. Is that what you're getting at? Or
Definitely. Because, you know, the poems, gosh, there's, you know, with experimental poetry, there's so much architecture happening. That we create, I think, with a certain kind of honesty too, but it's certainly the stories that might be most overtly trying for honesty in this book.
That's, you know, there are so many ways to think of what an experimental poem is, and there's so many sort of contending definitions, but you just say, well, to start off with saying, well, experimental poem is a place where there's just so much architecture happening. Mm-hmm. And that's true. You know, I think something that's a little more, I don't know, for lack of a better word, mainstream, it's a place where you kind of know where all the rooms are and what they look like and what the structure looks like. But in an avant-garde poem, you have no idea how low the ceilings are going to be or what room you're going to turn to next.
Right. Yeah. I think folks sometimes, gosh, underestimate what lyric poetry can do and does accomplish in its best forms, only because there are so many decisions that have to be made when we're not occupying the conventional forms and conventional ways of writing. And so we are coming up with rules and philosophies behind what it is that we're doing. And I try and teach students who are writing lyrically to have these rules and philosophies behind the choices they make, as small as, when will I use a comma and in what cases can I change how that use happens? That's important.
And I think it's for the reader to have, it's really important for the reader to have that kind of faith that the poet's doing that the poet has a set of rules for when they're going to use a comma, as you were saying, and then also a set of rules for when to pull the rug out from under the reader and say, oh, there was supposed to be, I turned the corner and the lights were off, and I thought the lights were going to be on there. It's really great. It's something that Julie Carr had said about the serial poem, where she talked about that idea of like you come into a new room in the serial poem, and it's like a room with the lights off, and you turn them on, and it's an entirely different kind of room. And I think that works really well for the serial poem, but I think for a lot of experimental work too. So with I'm thinking of more specifically about the book, the poem "Dear Incubator" is a real touchstone for the book. It seems to me like everything else in the book emanates from what this poem is doing.
Yeah, the wild thing is that I wrote Dear Incubator last, really.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
My friend and reader, Douglas Kearney, who's also a poet, he read my book several times in its different iterations, and as it was coming to its final self or something like it, he said that he felt something was missing, and it was something that put the body forward, put a mythology about the body forward, that the other poems sort of responded to and responded from. And it didn't take me but a moment while he was even speaking to think of my early birth, premature birth, and the figure of the incubator. I'd always wanted to write about it, but somehow the idea and the moment and the opportunity don't all come together until these moments, these unexpected moments. And so I finally had this way to write about the incubator that made complete and utter sense to me.
And the incubator is it's one of the things I love about the poem is that the incubator is a machine. Of course, it's not something cold, it kept you alive. But as a reader, we're experiencing it as a machine, but it's just so intimate. It's as intimate as the body in the poem.
Well, this will be some experiential information that I've never shared before, but when I was young, and I'm talking a young kid up until my teen years, I would have these moments where I was going to sleep at night and the environment would seem to grow larger around me. And it really didn't matter if my eyes were open or closed. It was just this visceral sensibility that I was either growing smaller and the air around me was growing larger. And I always equated that back to the incubator because the sense of it was actually really frightening when it would happen. And I say, well, that's important. That must be it. What other small space did I occupy?
Yeah, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you was like, how palpable were your mem are your memories of the incubator? And you're kind of getting at it right now that they're coming to you in these palpable fragments, or they came to you in palpable fragments when you were younger.
Well, I remember distinctly one time I cried because of this experience of feeling something looming around me and not being able to stop that sense. And so it's interesting now how contentious my relationship with the incubator is, in that there is love for that other womb. But it also is a very frightening space to be quarantined or secluded. All right.
And it's like it's this terrifying, frightening space that it's also pre-verbal too, and yet there it is rendered in language.
My parents actually had tapes recorded of their voices and jazz and everything, and they played those while they weren't at the hospital with me.
Now, this is a stretch, but do you have any memories of warm human voices or jazz at all in that terrifying space, or is that almost too much to ask of your memory?
Actually, I do not, which is how I found out. I asked my parents, "Well, what did you do? Were you always there? And you know, when you weren't there, what was happening?" And so they did tell me about recordings they would make.
And how did that feel? Were they like, I mean, they're talking about you and this, you know, your earliest days on the planet, and it's nothing, you know, you don't remember any of this. Did it feel like they were really talking about you, or did it feel like they were talking almost about somebody else?
Someone else, actually, because my parents, they're very factual about my birth, and there's, you know, I'm sure at the time I was dangerously close to death a couple times, and so at the time I'm sure they were highly emotional and just trying to understand how to keep me alive and how the doctors would do it. And so when they relay information to me now, it's all very, yes, we play these tapes for you, we make jazz, but it's not any more connected with an emotional intimacy or something that's fraught like it might have been back then in 81.
When you knew they were feeling it then, and now they're just giving you the, you know, here's what happened, here's what we did, and here's what occurred, sort of thing. You know, talking as you were talking now about your parents kind of filling in the gaps about what went on in those early days. Have they had any significant response to this poem over any of the others in the book?
My parents enjoy that I'm a poet and they appreciate that I write, but we don't honestly get into the poems as specific spaces of dialogue. No.
No, that was sort of my experience with my folks. One time I did a reading, and afterwards my father said that was really good. And for a half second I thought, wow, are we going to have a dialogue about the poems? That'd be pretty cool. And then after that pause, he said, you're a very good public speaker.
Oh.
And it was really sweet. And I said, well, that's my job. And he said, I know, and you do it well. And I said, well, thank you very much, Dad. And it was great. But you know, you used the phrase earlier. You're talking about how Dear Incubator gives or you know, establishes a kind of mythology about the body in the book, and the body is vital to the book. And can you talk about what that how would you describe what the mythology of the body is in the book?
Well, in its start with the incubator, there's this incredible amount of tension roaming throughout the book, and it really comes from a place of desire and want, really. I just wrote an essay about this actually for Josh Wilkinson. Yeah, but I can't understand or explain that level of want, but to say it must be the want to be alive enough to experience everything that comes in the text. And so you have the body that one desires to be, and then the body that desires to experience itself in relationships, in being gendered and sexed, etc.
Yeah, it's a desired body and a desiring body at the same time, and it's nice. Sometimes we just like if it, you know, literary critical circles, we usually just talk about desire. But I like when I'm in a situation where I'm reading a book of poems and I feel, you know, the role of the body is both desired and desiring. It feels more fully human to me. And as you're talking about that openness of the body, you know, it seems really. What I'm struck by, I know, somebody else had mentioned that there's a vulnerability of the body, and you talk about that in the poems too. But it's also like a fragility. The body is fragile in the book, but the fragility, for me anyway, is part of what makes it the body one of the vital systems. You know, it's vital. The fragility is vital rather than bringing the body down. Can you talk a little bit about the title poem, The Vital System, and its importance to the book?
Yeah, sure. Well, you talk about this vulnerability, which is definitely a part of the text, the whole text. But there's a moment in Dear Incubator where I think about the skin, my skin, and it was a translucent skin, you know, my viscera was able to be seen when I was premature and in that incubator. And so I think of how bare, vulnerable, subject to the outside, that something like that is, and say, well, why not carry it through the other poems and let that body speak through the other poems? And Dear Incubator was, again, the origin story that actually was the last poem to be written. And so who knows if in part of myself I knew that the whole time. But it certainly seemed to be a poem that gave reason to the need for speech of all the other poems in the book. And this notion of memory, of fear, of appreciation, of needing to articulate something about a state or states of being.
And that moment that you mentioned in Dear Incubator, where you talk about the skin being translucent, you know, thinking of the you know, my skin was, I'm looking at the book right now, my skin was translucent, and then that next moment, anyone could see me working. It's just that vulnerability, but the body's working, and that, you know, it's anyone could see me working, keeping myself alive under really terrifying circumstances. And that does seem part of the, you know, vulnerability that's also really powerful in the book. I want us to hear a poem in a second, but before we do that, can you say something a bit more about the poem The Vital System? Does that extend what we've been saying about the body, or do you feel like it takes it what we've been saying in a different direction?
It extends it. That's a strange little poem, I have to admit. I mean, it's so vastly experimental. I feel that it's not one that I read all the time. I have to read it very slowly for people to occupy it, I think. But it is about the body, but it turns very much toward the female body, in that this is how it was created, and possibly that notion of the origin story again, but also if in states of let's see, subjugation, I might say, the vital system articulates that body politic.
From the state of subjugation.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I like thinking of it that way. It's from that state of subjugation, and I also feel as a reader that there are some sharp edges there. Like you said, you have to read it very slowly to let people occupy it at readings, and I think, yeah, if people aren't careful, they could kind of cut on those sharp edges, which I think is also good. I like to get cut on the sharp edges of a poem. You know, I'm not going to, I can fix the wound. It's a good wound from reading, you know? Well, let's hear a poem from either from the book or a new poem.
Okay. Do you want to hear Dear Incubator?
Well, I'm going to speak for the millions of people listening to this podcast all over the world and say, yes, why not?
All right. Dear Incubator. At 6 months gestation, I am a fabrication born far too soon. My body, a stone in a steaming basket. I remember you, figureless, a black kaleidoscope. Turn, turn, the dangerous loom of the loom of you, patterns pressing upon me inside. Nothing luminous as my mother's womb. This second attempt at formation, a turn. The nurse slides her wedding band past my hand, beyond my elbow, and over my shoulder. I am 1 pound, 12 ounces, and already feminine, knowing nothing of it. I am trying to be clear. I was first fascinated, then afraid of the shapes rise from your darkness and their growth toward me. I wailed under their weight. My eyes were shuttered by lids. My skin was translucent. Anyone could see me working. How can I ask you from inside the poem? What senses did I have so early, so unformed? I was tangled in tubes that kept my heart pumping, that kept my lungs from collapsing, food to the body, oxygen to the brain. You are everything and nothing, a surrogate, a packaging of half-made sensory detail, a past. I have scars on my belly in shapes of fish, where sensors tore a thin skin. What a tragedy to be powerless, and yet I control the choreography of everyone around me, the check of vitals, arms through the arm ports, my parents' speech. Also, there were surgeons. I'm trying to tell you something important about after they opened you and took me out. I was infected, could command nothing of my legs for years. The surgeon's thin blade shining into nothing. Imagine the cuts, blood spread along the lip of each, spilling as my skin parts. Someone bringing cotton to catch it. Is it your fault? I don't know. I was in a state, I've explained. I don't know what you let in. Perhaps. You know, lovers ask about these scars, touch these raised scars. So much has happened. I'm black. I have a dead sister. I love you, but, and believe this, I mostly want to talk.
You're listening to C.M. Burroughs on Radio Free Albion, and that was C.M. reading the poem Dear Incubator from The Vital System. You know, at the end of the poem, I want to get the exact lines. At the end of the poem, the next to last stanza, is it your fault, incubator? I'll add incubator, that's who you're talking to. Is it your fault, incubator? I don't know. I was in a state, I've explained. I don't know what you let in.
Mm-hmm.
What did the incubator let in? And the question, so abstract. I don't mean it to be ridiculously abstract. I'm thinking, like, for a reader, what should a reader be thinking the incubator let in?
Well, I could say let in, and I can also think about what does it keep in. And if, let's say, the body is trapped in there with all things that made it and are currently making it, then that vulnerability is definitely one of those parts. Parts coming in, staying in, being let to stay in.
And the book is so physical in the ways you were just talking about, the ways we've been talking about the architecture of all the poems in the book. It's such a physical book. I don't want to neglect also that your poems are sonic. You know, they tell the reader, you know, listen to the sounds. It's worth it. There's music here. What's the relationship for you between writing and sound, or writing and music?
Yeah. Well, anecdote. So when I was a kid, let's say 9 years old, I remember driving. I was riding in my mother's van with a bunch of other, you know, kids my age. These popular girls. I was always a bit of a geek. I'm so proud of that now. But I think some song by Naughty by Nature, whomever came on the radio. And what was happening is I started tapping my foot, but I wasn't tapping my foot to the beat of the song. There was no movement on the beat. It was to the words of the song, which is something I had always sort of, you know, done without thinking about it. And I only noticed it that day because around the van, the girls started whispering to one another and pointing and teasing me. Right? And I'm like, you don't have anything better to do. But, you know, it was the beginning of my realizing, oh, I do this thing, and it's not just this time, but I'm always tapping my foot to words, and I do it now even. Mm-hmm. And so there's something about music, and maybe this goes back to my parents playing music for me while I was in the incubator, and so there's some innate understanding about it, about how sound and melody can work. But it's this notion of how can I create words in such a way that they will allow me to tap my foot to them, right? And I'm not explicitly talking about meter, but in terms of assonance and alliteration and hidden sounds, what can we do there? And I really appreciate music and there being not only a narrative of the poem, but a narrative of the sounds of the poem.
And like you said, the hidden sounds too. I mean, it's like, I know what you're describing, it would be very easy, and there's truth to it, easy to say, oh, she's talking about meter. And I know that's not what you're not saying, right? I mean, you are talking about that, but like you said, it's also the hidden sounds of a poem. And those are things we can sort of figuratively and sometimes literally tap our feet to. I love the story. It's like, where do poets come from? Well, we sit in a car and we do this thing that all the time that nobody else is doing, and people look at us and point.
Yeah, I was so upset.
Earlier you talked about your friend, the fellow poet, Douglas Kearney, and I wanted to focus on something he said about your work that I thought is something I kept coming back to as I was rereading the book. He described your work this way: the narrator of these poems seems to come apart before my eyes, yet she never disintegrates. She teems. Here is vivid grief, livid vulnerability, and bristling sensuality. And I was returning to this a lot through the book, but especially when I was reading some of the poems towards the end, like Black Memorabilia and The Personal Camp Eroticism.
I appreciate Doug in every possible way. He's an astounding person and poet. But I have to say, the image that is always in my mind when I think about this notion of coming apart but not disintegrating, as Doug says, is there is a trembling wire, and that trembling wire represents my work, and it's pulled tight, but not tightly enough to stop, quivering, but it's still wire, it's still a strong material. And he's right. I mean, the characters of the book refuse to be hurt in such a way that causes them not to be anymore.
That they refuse to be hurt in a way that causes them not to be. Yeah. And they do that while also, being open and vulnerable. It's something that, when I do the interviews, I don't always want to talk about teaching because not every poet teaches, and we shouldn't always think of it that way. Poetry is something about teaching. But I'm thinking of that moment right now. Sometimes with our students, when I feel like students are getting, for lack of a better phrase, getting a voice for the first time, sometimes that empowering moment, they'll feel like, well, I can't be vulnerable. I have to just be strong and stick my face out there. And you want to do that, but sometimes that strength can come from being really vulnerable too, and being on that wire, like you're saying.
Yeah, I actually think of that I live in that way, if that makes sense. And that I am not a large person by any means. I'm rather petite. And so I know in the world I am vulnerable. What makes up my armor is a vulnerable thing. And truthfully, I always hold my head, my chin a bit upward so that I think I'm taller than I am. And I always see myself in photographs, and my body is so, I'm 5'4" and 109 pounds, and I look so much smaller than I conceive myself to be. Gosh, what a thing.
But that's, I mean, that's you. How did you put it? I look smaller than I conceive myself to be. And yet at the same time, you're also saying I'm living that wire. And I think we have to, as poets, I mean, we all have different images. I love the wire, the trembling wire. I think that's where, I don't want to sound, I'm afraid I'm going to sound like we're shamans around a fire or something, which is not what I want the podcast to sound like. But I do think that's where the poems come from. We don't erase that vulnerability from our lives. We know we have to like pay bills and stop at a red light, but we have to wear our nerves on the outside sometimes.
That wire is something that returns to me countless numbers of times, even in the classroom. I mean, my students asked me last semester, one of them said, "What do you mean when you say there's something at stake? There has to be something."
Yes, that phrase.
And I immediately, this trembling wire touched into my mind, and I explained that first, but then I also said, there's something in the poem that has the ability to be lost, right? And there's a fighting for that thing, whatever it might be.
I'm thinking of all the times in class when I'm asked that same question, like, Tony, why do you always say, what's at stake in the poem? Why do you always say that? And then I laugh and I say, God, I know. It's like, we always say that, don't we? This or that's at stake. And then everyone laughs. And then I say, well, but there is something at stake here. Like, you know, if I want to think that when I read this poem, I'm going to be a little different when I'm done reading it. And that means there was something at stake and it was communicated to me.
Yeah, it's something that's said, but it's so important and so real.
Something that's said that's so real that I guess, I don't know, that you can't avoid it or that the reader can't avoid it or the reader has to absorb it or something like that?
Well, yeah, but the thing is, when that question was asked, I was so surprised. I just had to pause for a second because I was never asked that question before. And I think I took it for granted and thought, well, of course, everyone knows what this means. There's something at stake. But perhaps not, right?
Yeah, I love those moments in the classroom, right? It's like, that's the same way I felt about it. Like, the first time it was said to me, I just found my way for that to make sense to me. Mm-hmm. But then there were like 10 other things that my fellow students made sense to them that I had to ask about. So I'm like, okay, I got to really answer this because this is really good. I'm glad I'm being put on the spot.
Right. That's the thing though. If, you know, we might've had a very innate understanding of what it means to have something at stake, but that's not always going to come internally for everyone. And so not only was I surprised by it being asked of me, but I was surprised at having to come up with, you know, a reasonable, clear answer for it.
Yeah, it's that other part. Oh, now I have to answer it reasonably clearly. I know. Well, you know, since we're talking about teaching, you know, I said earlier how, and it's how I feel about teaching and poetry, and it's not that different from what a lot of other people feel, that it's teaching and poetry go together well. It's a really important, it's a really great job for poets to have. I think it makes the poetry better, and you know, being a poet makes the teaching better. Yeah. But at the same time, it's like it's not always what we do as poets. And I'm always interested in the other ways we've supported ourselves or currently support ourselves as poets outside the regular route of teaching. So, like, I'm wondering what's the strangest or the weirdest job you've ever had?
Gosh, I think, I graduated University of Pittsburgh with my master's in 2007, had no money, really, and I needed a job to sort of subsist until I actually started teaching, which happened the next spring or the next fall. So I sold eyeglasses. I was a salesperson in an eyeglass boutique mm-hmm. in a mall, no less. And so every morning I would drive like 45 minutes outside of Pittsburgh proper to go sell eyeglasses. And I had nightmares about this gig because it was known that I was there short term. It was known that I was a poet and a teacher. And I used that sort of forged connections with some of the clientele when I talked to them about glasses and reading and things. And so it was as if I was trying to reinforce through the drudgery of being on my feet all day and trying to bear the techno music that this is what I do. Let me not forget. Don't you forget, buy these glasses, but this is what I am.
don't you forget, you need these glasses to read the poems that I'm reading. Yeah. I drove 45 minutes out of Pittsburgh to sell eyeglasses, and I was still an ambassador for poetry. That's great.
Yeah. I say this as I'm wearing a brand new pair of glasses now. I love them. They're so, I can see very sharply now.
You know, it's funny. As you were saying that, I was thinking in about 3 weeks, I've got new glasses coming and I can't wait to see them. And I'm thinking, oh my God, they better look when they're here and arrived. And you know, when I'm taking them out of the store, they better look as good as I thought they did when I purchased them. Cause I'll feel so horrible. You spent so much money on these important things. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's hear another poem.
Okay. I'll read the last one in the book. And this poem references what Dear Incubator does briefly in saying, I have a dead sister, after so much has happened. But this poem took years to arrive, or I took years to arrive to this poem, in that my sister died in 1998, and for the years following, I attempted to write several poems about my sister's dying, and it was always from the perspective of grieving, of course. That's what I go through to get to the expression of it. But I was free writing one day, and somehow I thought, well, let me write a poem from the perspective of looking at my dad, of her speaking, of her having to make a choice. And so this poem came from that. A young girl and a hooded attendant. You must have in your muscles your threshold of pain, said when the light, whole, or gracious hand appeared. Yes. First looked behind you to the macrame of tubers, rigs, and your body's openings that were made openings through which slender metal mouths sucked or spewed all the black, the sterilized tears, the life and lifelessness of that place. Must have looked on all it amounted, surveyed the wilt, rot, measurable ravage, and looked away. What intelligent sickness. Rather, what is in front of you answers how the water and the wood bridge leading to the water signify a freedom only felt when going under. Count backward from 100. 100. 99. 98. It doesn't take what you think it takes to leave the body. What it requires is that you admit yourself, the bleak shelter of your body against the calm. 92, 91, of what impresses your optic nerve, yourself woundless and saturating that desire further corrected colors.
That was C.M. Burroughs reading A Young Girl and a Hooded Attendant, the final poem in her collection, The Vital System. You've been listening to C.M. Burroughs on Radio Free Albion today, and her most recent book is The Vital System, which was published in 2012 by Tupelo Press, and it's available at the usual online spots, including independent sites like Small Press Distribution, spdbooks.org, and at bookstores that carry books of poetry from independent presses. To get to know C.M. and her work a little bit more, go to her website, cmburrows.com. Thanks for coming on the show, CM. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks, Tony. A lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Albion. If you're a poet and you'd like to be on a future show, or if you just want to email me and tell me what you thought of today's show, you can get in touch with me at Radio Free Albion. That's one word. RadioFreeAlbion@gmail.com. You can also go to the show's Twitter page, twitter.com/RadioFreeAlbion. Thanks again for listening.